in class together. Over and over, she made Miles promise never to allow Cindy to sit alone at lunch, even though he explained there were days that Cindy never appeared in the cafeteria or came in late in the company of a teacher, or after Miles had already found a seat and eaten half of his lunch. Sometimes, too, she sat with Mr. Boniface. What he didn't tell his mother was that Cindy often sat by herself at one end of a table designed for 20 students or more, the other end overcrowded with laughing, boisterous kids who seemed purposefully unaware of her existence. To a stranger entering the cafeteria for the first time, it would have appeared that Cindy Whiting was made of different, heavier materials from those that formed her classmates, as if 20 of them were required to balance their end of a teeter-totter. Nor did Miles inform his mother of his own ingenious methods of keeping his promise to her, of leaving the table where he'd eaten lunch with his friends a few minutes before the bell to stop by Cindy's table for a minute or two. Sometimes he timed it so that he arrived just as the bell rang, and there was nothing to do besides carry her tray. The terrible truth was that such slender gestures seemed even to Miles at 16 both too much and too little, more than just about everyone else was willing to do, but far less than conscience dictated. For he did have a conscience. He became painfully aware of it, a dagger through his stingy heart each time Cindy beamed her hopeful smile up at him. But it wasn't just Cindy Whiting his mother was obsessed with. Gradually, Grace came to dwell on everything that transpired in the Whiting household. She came home worried about bagworms spinning their silky pouches in the hydrangea, worried that the shrimp from the supermarket would not be fresh for Saturday's gathering with the hospital planning board, worried that the house itself was too isolated across the river, where its inhabitants might prove vulnerable to all manner of miscreants sneaking over the iron bridge. Though at times vague and abstracted, his mother was doubly grateful to Miles for being such a help to her. He learned to cook dinner for himself and his little brother, and she trusted him with enough money to buy such basics as toilet paper, laundry detergent, and milk. "I don't know why I can't seem to focus anymore," she confessed to him, when she forgot something at the store or failed to pay the phone bill. "I swear I don't know where my mind is half the time." Miles knew exactly where it was, though he loved her too much to point out the obvious. His mother had found another family. Mrs. Whiting seemed genuinely fond of him from the start, which surprised Miles, given her views on youth. The woman made no secret of her opinion that teenagers belonged in institutions for the criminally insane, from which they should not be released until the word cool had been purged from their vocabulary. She made no secret of her other forceful opinions either. Each afternoon, she pulled up in front of the high school in her Lincoln at precisely 3:35. Classes let out at 3:20, but then all the school buses lined up outside and students from all four grades stampeded out of the quadruple doors. A crush of inconsiderate humanity that an unsteady girl had no business in the middle of. By this point in her life, Cindy was accustomed to waiting for crowds to disperse. When she traveled anywhere with her mother, they remained with the frightened elderly, the parents with small children, and the emotionally timid, while the strong and swift cleared the aisles. They avoided sales in department stores, queues for ice cream and popcorn at the lake, anything at all that might involve jostling. Over the years, Cindy had come to understand that if she was patient, there would be plenty of popcorn and ice cream left over. She could enjoy the same treats that the fleet and well-balanced enjoyed, just not with them. So only after the phalanx of buses departed, crammed with their cargoes of Empire Falls's Vandals and Huns, Goths and Visigoths, did the Lincoln pull into one of the spaces marked for school buses only. Though grateful to Mrs. Whiting for helping him learn to drive, Miles immediately understood the cost of the instruction. Now, in addition to any lunchtime kindnesses, he was required to spend another 10 or 15 minutes with Cindy after school, as they waited for her mother. Though both juniors, they had different home rooms, so Miles, after the first wave of students had left, helped Cindy carry her things to the front entrance. In warm weather, they sometimes waited outside, until they discovered they would have to endure less ridicule if they stayed indoors. Ridicule was nothing new to Cindy Whiting, of course. During grade school, her classmates' cruel pantomimes of her lurching gait resembled that of the monster in the old Frankenstein movies, holding his arms out from his sides for balance. The Whiting Walk, they called it, and there were contests to judge whose rendition was best. During recess, it was not unusual to see three or four boys practicing at the same time, stumbling into the slide or the swing set, bouncing off any objects at hand. The Whiting Walk was such soul-satisfying fun that it carried over into junior high, until the day a girl from the high school, Charlene Gardner, who was there because her little brother had forgotten his lunch money, came upon a group of boys following the Whiting girl down the corridor, all of them doing their Whiting Walk. When Cindy turned around, they pretended awkward innocence. Seeing this, Charlene Gardner had become furious and asked the boys in a tone of withering contempt whether they thought they'd ever grow up. Among the boys at the junior high, there was no one whose disapproval carried greater weight than Charlene Gardner's, since she possessed the choicest set of melons in all of Empire Falls, no contest. One of the boys in the hall that day, Jimmy Minty, having seen her in a bikini at the lake the previous summer, had spent the whole fall semester recounting the experience of watching her bend over to pick up her tube of suntan lotion. To have your maturity questioned by Charlene Gardner was definitely a scrotum shrinker, and from that moment on, the Whiting Walk became uncool, and all its former practitioners were convinced that they had, as requested, grown up. Which perhaps explained why it came as such a tremendous relief that first spring afternoon, when Cindy Whiting and Miles Roby were observed together as they waited for her mother to rescue them. Sure, it was still uncool to make fun of Cindy Whiting by herself, but as part of a couple, she was again fair game, even though Miles was the ostensible object of this new derision. Boys who already had their driver's license would roar out of the parking lot, honking their horns and leaning out their windows to shout sexual encouragement to him as he sat there with Cindy Whiting on a stone bench gifted to the school by the class of 43. Even more satisfying was to moon them, though this happened only once because the mooners themselves were victimized by bad luck and poor timing. Their intention had been a limited tactical strike against the two losers on the bench, but no sooner had they framed their pimply asses in the windows of a speeding car than Mr. Boniface emerged unexpectedly from the building, his attention drawn by the honking horn. The view he was treated to stopped him in his tracks, and he watched until the car careened around the corner and out of sight. The wiggling asses might have belonged to anyone, of course, but Mr. Boniface recognized the car and thus quickly identified and suspended the appropriate scholars. Their bad luck was exacerbated by the principal's assumption that he was their intended target, a misapprehension they were hard-pressed to correct. There didn't seem to be an adequate way of explaining that they hadn't meant to moon him, but rather a crippled girl. Even waiting inside the building did not inoculate Miles and Cindy Whiting against ridicule, of course. One afternoon, the entire varsity baseball team, trailed by a grinning Mr. Brown, trotted out of the locker room chanting, "Go, Roby, go! Go, Roby, go!" all the way out to the baseball diamond. In truth, this jeering had a more profound effect on Miles than on Cindy Whiting, who either didn't understand its import or was pretending not to. "What do they mean? Go, Roby, go?" she wondered innocently, causing Miles, who'd flushed crimson when the varsity trotted by, to glow even more hotly. Miles, hoping to keep Cindy from reiterating her declaration of love, took to directing their conversations to neutral academic subjects and often helped her with her homework, especially English, which happened to be his best subject and her worst. To Miles, her incomprehension had less to do with stupidity than with stubbornness. For some reason, she angrily blamed each and every author in their literature text for her inability to deduce their intention and meaning, And when Miles tried to explain a troublesome passage or concept, her face became a mask of resentment and frustration. Poetry in particular infuriated her. To her way of thinking, it was like Pig Latin, designed for the sole purpose of allowing those in the know to enjoy the discomfort of those who weren't. Miles suggested that poems weren't really written in code, and that they weren't nearly as difficult as she was making them. But in fact, even simple, obvious metaphors threw her for a loop, and more sophisticated forms of figurative language filled her with angry indignation. "It's simple," Miles said one afternoon. "It's called personification. The speaker of the poem is comparing death to a coachman. Because I could not stop for death, he kindly stopped for me." "If that's what she means, why doesn't she just say it?" "She is saying it," Miles said, pointing to the line. The girl's failure to grasp something so simple mystified him. If anyone might be expected to have a feeling for Emily Dickinson, he'd have bet it would be Cindy. But she refused to even look at the page. The poem had made her feel inferior, so she wanted nothing more to do with it. Staring at the line in question would only deepen her conviction that there could be no justification for this or any other poem. "Why doesn't she say it so I can understand it?" she insisted. Miles thought it might be wise not to answer this question, and so he said, trying to keep the exasperation out of his voice, "Well, do you understand it now that I've explained it?" "No," she assured him mulishly, and as if to dissuade him from any further attempts at enlightenment, she emphatically closed the book, shoved it into her canvas bag, struggled to her feet, took up her cane, and hobbled across the hall to the lavatory. In her anger and haste, however, she hadn't completely closed the bag, and Miles noticed the thin paperback that didn't look anything like a schoolbook, wedged sideways among the texts. He had no business going through her things, but he couldn't help wondering what sort of reading might appeal to someone so militantly resistant to the subtleties of language. The cover, depicting a summer camp setting with two giggling teenage girls sneaking off into the woods after a pair of beckoning teenage boys, looked innocent enough. It resembled those books aimed at seventh-grade girls, the kind read aloud at slumber parties. So Miles was surprised to discover that its contents, at least on the page whose corner was turned down, were mildly pornographic. The passage his eye fell on had two girls, presumably the same ones depicted on the cover, secretly watching half a dozen boys roughhousing in the river. The boys were all naked, and one of them, Jules, was particularly worthy of their attention. "The thing between his legs, so strange and so thrilling, made Pam's pussy pucker," Miles read. This sentiment certainly required no gloss. He managed to slip the book into the canvas bag just as Cindy stepped back into the hall. "And what's more," she said, apparently taking up the discussion right where they'd left off, "I don't believe you really understand those poems either. I think you're just pretending." "Fine," Miles said, no longer interested in arguing the merits of poetry. The dreadful fact of the matter was that the passage he'd read, its ridiculous alliteration aside, had given him an erection, and there was something about knowing that Cindy Whiting read and presumably enjoyed such books that made the situation worse. When she settled onto the bench next to him, it was as if she was suddenly sitting there naked, and he recalled that her expression, when they'd been surprised last week by the Mooners, their bare asses and dangling genitals framed in the car windows, had not been exactly what he'd expected. "I think you're all just pretending," she continued obstinately. "And why are you looking at me like that?" But at that moment a horn tooted outside, and they saw the black Lincoln idling at the curb. Miles pivoted when he stood and rearranged himself behind his books, and then a strange thought crossed his mind. What the Lincoln reminded him of was death's coach in Emily Dickinson's poem. Under Mrs. Whiting's tutelage, Miles' driving showed steady improvement, much of which was attributable to his very first lesson. After they switched seats, Miles had just pulled cautiously away from the curb when Mrs. Whiting told him to pull over again. "Dear boy," she said, Are you always like this? The question, compounded by the way she was looking at him, caused Miles to feel an inadequacy that transcended automotive matters, as though her question hinted at some larger character flaw. Like what? He heard himself ask. Like paralyzed with fear. This is a very nice car, he pointed out. Ah, there it is, she replied, pleased with herself for discovering who knew what. She was still regarding him fixedly, causing Miles to wonder if the conversation would right itself soon or just continue to defy his comprehension. His mother had warned him that Mrs. Whiting would be like no one else in his experience, and now he understood her inability to explain in any detail. Mrs. Whiting was several years older than his mother, he knew, which put her in her mid to late 40s. But if she looked her age in some hard-to-define way, she didn't seem her age. Miles was aware that Grace had been a very beautiful woman, and at times, though less and less frequently now, he would be reminded of her former beauty. In the years since their return from Martha's Vineyard, she had settled into middle age, as had all the mothers of his friends and acquaintances. Strangely, one had only to glance at Mrs. Whiting to know she'd never been beautiful, probably never even pretty. Her daughter, had she not been crippled as a child and made the transition into young womanhood to the awful cadence of ridicule, would have been far prettier. Yet from the moment she asked if he'd always been so frightened, what the woman seemed to convey to Miles was a kind of sexuality that, at least in his 16-year-old eyes, he'd not witnessed before in any woman her age. It was sexual inadequacy, he realized with a shock, that he'd felt when she looked at him, and that caused his cheeks to burn hot with embarrassment. "There what is?" he said, regretting the question immediately. "Your mother," she explained. "I didn't see her at all until you pointed out how nice this car is. Physically, you don't look like our Grace, but you share her timidity." Miles registered the "our Grace," but decided to ignore it. "It's your father you've got written all over you, of course," she said as if she imagined this to be a common pronouncement, which it wasn't. "Cindy is her father's daughter, too, aren't you, dear?" This seemed a rather hurtful thing for a mother to say, and Miles glanced in the rear-view mirror to see how Cindy Whiting would react to the observation, but her face couldn't have been more blank. Whether she looked like her father or not wasn't a question Miles himself had any opinion on, he supposed, never having met C.B. Whiting. According to Cindy, her father now lived more or less permanently in Mexico, where he oversaw a textile mill like the one that had closed in Empire Falls. Empire High might have been lacking in many qualities, but it had plenty of parking. There were about 100 yards of paved parking lot out back, most of it empty by late afternoon. Mrs. Whiting positioned Miles in such a way that the entire stretch lay before him, free of obstacles. Nothing beyond the pavement but a gentle, grassy slope, at the base of which was the school's oval quarter-mile track. "Okay," she said. "Floor it." Miles wasn't certain he heard her correctly. "You want me to..." "Correct," she said. "I don't, as in, depress the accelerator all the way to the floor." Miles considered the request. He was pretty sure there was no possibility of misunderstanding, but still. He located Cindy's face again in the mirror, and its expression bore about as much comprehension as he might have expected if her mother had recited a line of Elizabethan poetry. The only other car Miles had driven was the driver's ed vehicle, which was underpowered by design, so he was greatly surprised when the Lincoln leaped forward beneath his foot like a suddenly uncaged animal. When he instinctively let off the gas, she barked, "No!" all the way down above the roar of the engine. And so this time he did as he was told, the long parking lot flying past, the force of their momentum pushing them back into their seats, until Mrs. Whiting said, "Now would be a good time to stop, dear boy." She was right, too. Nearly out of parking lot, Miles ran out of still more between Mrs. Whiting's suggestion and the moment when his foot found and depressed the brake. The Lincoln slowed immediately, its tires squealing horribly. Seeing the car slow was gratifying, of course, but the sound of the tires seemed like a bad thing to Miles, and one the car's owner would surely disapprove of. So he let up on the brake until the screeching stopped, which meant they were still doing about 30 when the pavement ended and they began to bump down the grassy hill, all the way to the edge of the cinder track, where they finally came to a complete halt. Miles looked over at Mrs. Whiting, fully expecting her to concur with his last driving instructor that he was indeed a menace behind the wheel. But if she was upset with him, there was no indication. In the back, her daughter was also silent. "It might have been preferable to stop back up there," Mrs. Whiting observed calmly. "But never mind, this will do fine. Now, tell me what you just learned." "I'm not sure," Miles admitted. In fact, he was not sure whether or not he had wet his pants.
"I am," said Mrs. Whiting.
"You learned what would happen if you did something you were afraid to do. You learned how fast the car would go, and then you learned what it would take to stop it. You were surprised by both, but you won't be again." Miles nodded, feeling the strange truth of this. You can't possibly judge your ability to control something until you've experienced the extremes of its capabilities. Do you understand? He did. Frightened as he had just been, he now felt surprisingly good about sitting behind the wheel of the Lincoln, a different feeling entirely from losing control of the driver's ed car and ending up in that garage. "Power and control," Mrs. Whiting insisted. "There will be times when you'll have to put the accelerator down and other times when you'll have to stand on the brakes. Not very many, but some. Now you know the car, and you know that between those extremes, there's nothing to be frightened of. Correct?" They were, just then, still pointed downhill on a piece of high school property not designed for motor vehicles. "Now what?" he asked. "Now you get yourself out of this situation you got yourself into. Use your best judgment." Miles nodded, took a deep breath, removed his foot from the brake, and coasted out onto the cinder track. Trying to back up the grassy hill seemed like a dicey enterprise, so he simply steered the Lincoln around the oval track, grateful the track team had an away meet this afternoon. He'd nearly completed the entire quarter mile, spotted the tire tracks in the moist grass where he'd descended a few minutes before, and was about to follow them back up to the pavement when he became aware of a voice outside the car, calling,
"Hey! Hey! Stop! God damn it!"
and spied in the rearview mirror an apoplectic Mr. Brown chasing the Lincoln on foot. It was hard to know whether he'd been pursuing them all the way around the track or had picked them up at the final turn. In any case, the baseball coach arrived beet red and winded, and then came around the car and leaned against the hood, blocking Miles's escape route.
"Roby!" he wheezed when he saw who was behind the wheel. "I might have known."
Miles obliged him by rolling down the window so Mr. Brown could yell at him better.
"God damn it! What do you think you're doing? Do you have any idea how much that track costs?"
At that moment, Mrs. Whiting leaned across the seat, causing Mr. Brown to start at the sight of her.
"I do," she assured him. "I paid for it. Now get out of the way."
"Geez, Mrs. Whiting, I didn't see you there," the coach cried. "I had no idea.
Did you hear what I said?"
When Mr. Brown danced out of the way, Miles slowly followed his tire tracks up the hill until the Lincoln bumped back onto the blacktop and his former instructor fell out of sight in the rearview mirror. Cindy Whiting, who'd lapsed into a comatose silence ever since getting into the car, was still there, of course, and she offered up a tentative, almost frightened smile when she felt his eyes on her. In that moment, seeing only the part of her face that extended from her mouth to her eyes, framed in the rectangular mirror, Miles thought he saw someone else, someone vaguely familiar, someone he couldn't quite place.
"Power and control," Mrs. Whiting repeated, a smile playing at her lips.
Part 3 Chapter 15 It had been Miles's intention to close the restaurant by 11. The game started at 1:30, and he wanted to pick Cindy Whiting up shortly after noon in hopes of saving himself some embarrassment. A bigger hypocrite might have convinced himself it was Cindy Whiting he was trying not to embarrass, but Miles knew better. His thinking was to get to Empire Field before it got crowded, so the two of them could find seats in the lower bleachers on the home team side. Ascending into the upper reaches of the stands with Cindy's walker would not only take forever, but also would allow everyone in Empire Falls the opportunity to witness and reflect on the fact that Miles Roby was in the company of that poor, crippled Whiting girl who'd once tried to commit suicide over him. Also to speculate on whether he was positioning himself to marry all that money once his divorce became final. By Monday morning, he'd be overhearing jokes at the restaurant. He'd spent much of his virtually sleepless night feverishly climbing and reclimbing these imaginary bleachers, pausing only long enough to replay what Charlene had said to him in the lamplighter after his brother left, that she'd have let him make love to her except for her fear he'd be disappointed. What he should have replied, this came to him at 3 a.m, was that he'd take his chances if she would. But that, after all, had been her point. She wasn't telling him that he might be disappointed, but that he would be, his own certainty to the contrary notwithstanding. She hadn't offered him a choice accompanied by a stern warning so much as a kind and loving explanation. Was it possible she was right? In an attempt to resolve the question and to keep from going back to climbing bleachers with Cindy Whiting, he tried to imagine Charlene following him back to the Empire Grill in her decrepit Hyundai, there slipping in the back door and up the dark rear stairs. That part was easy and delicious in its intimate anticipation, and he had no trouble imagining a kiss there in the dark or the warmth of Charlene's body against his. They'd worked together in close quarters for many years, so he knew her smell, even how her body felt, and he was smart enough not to clutter his fantasy with dialogue. Though Charlene might be a talker, it was easier to imagine silence than to imagine her speaking the words he needed her to say. But then the fantasy failed, utterly. When it came time to undress her, he discovered that the woman standing before him wasn't Charlene at all. She was Cindy Whiting, and not Cindy at her present age, but rather as a young woman, approaching him without reservation, even in his middle age. "Dear Miles," she whispered, as if to reassure him it was all right that he'd aged and thickened. "Dear, dear Miles." So, back to climbing and reclimbing the bleachers for another long hour, his failure of imagination even more disheartening than the endless ascent. At least, he told himself, in the bleachers, they were both clothed. He finally fell asleep around 4, and the alarm went off at 5:15. Dopey with exhaustion, he stayed too long in the shower in a vain attempt to wash the long night away, putting himself behind schedule even before the restaurant opened. Worse, the breakfast crowd, which he'd hoped would be small on game day, was large, steady, and talkative, full of anticipation and energy. He managed to run the last customers off by 11, but he didn't want to leave a mess for David and Charlene and the rest of the evening crew, who'd have their hands full when the Empire Grill reopened at 6. So it was past noon before he finished the cleanup, and 12:30 by the time he showered off the smell of sausage grease, and 1 before he picked Cindy up, and 1:15 before he found a place to park on a side street adjacent to Empire Field, and 1:25 before they began to climb the cold metal bleachers on the visitor's side of the field, the only place where there were still seats, and those up near the top. At 1:30, just as Empire Falls kicked off, they finally completed the climb that Miles had begun in bed 12 hours before. Cindy had left her walker at home, content to use a sturdy cane for balance on one side and sturdy Miles Roby on the other. And by the time he'd stared malignantly at a woman in the top row until she moved down so he and Cindy could sit on the aisle, Empire Falls was already behind, 7-0. Fairhaven, having returned the opening kickoff for a touchdown. Miles sat there, sweating and bushed.
"Oh, Miles, look,"
Cindy said. From the top of the bleachers, they could see all the way to the river. It was the first weekend in October, and the air was crisp, the leaves approaching their peak, the Knox River sparkling the blue of reflected sky. Empire Falls looked, in fact, like it had been replaced overnight with a better version of itself. Cindy hooked her arm through his, pressing a warm breast against his elbow, and he felt, after too many months of abstinence, a stirring he tried to ignore.
"You know what I feel like?"
she wanted to know, and for a moment the question confused him. Popcorn? Candy? Good God, they just sat down.
"I feel like a schoolgirl."
Miles knew what she meant. He'd have preferred a schoolgirl, too, especially if it meant he himself could be a schoolboy. "Too bad all you have is a middle-aged man for company." Unfortunately, levity had never had much effect on Cindy Whiting, even as a girl. She gripped the biceps of his left arm with both hands and said,
"Dear Miles,"
just as she had last night in his dream,
"there's not a soul on earth I'd rather be with."
And with that, she pulled herself up his arm and kissed his cheek wetly, holding on to the kiss until it was interrupted by the clanging sound of her cane as it slipped between the bleachers and rattled to the ground below.
"Oh, nuts," she said happily. "You see what comes of passion?"
"This," Miles said, showing her where Timmy had bitten him half an hour earlier, "is what comes of passion." The puncture marks were still visible, two small white dots. The wound now resembled what it had felt like at the time, a snake bite. In a matter of minutes, his whole hand had swollen up like a mitt, though by now the swelling had gone down a little.
"Poor Miles," his companion said, stroking the wound gently with the back of her fingers. "Does it hurt?"
"No," he said, jerking his hand away and rubbing it vigorously against his corduroy knee. "It itches like hell." What it reminded him of, he realized, was the poison ivy he'd contracted all those years ago on the vineyard. And like that itch, this one returned, worse than before, the moment he quit scratching.
"Stop, silly. You'll make it swell up even worse."
"I don't care," Miles told her, digging at it with his fingernails now. Actually, he did care. He was fervently hoping that the swelling would go down by evening, so he wouldn't have to admit to his brother that, once again, he'd come back from Mrs. Whiting's wounded. It was hard to believe that the animal had managed to surprise him yet again. Miles had been on the lookout, too, dropping his guard only as they were about to leave. Cindy had asked him to hand her a scarf hanging in the hall closet, the door of which was ajar. Reaching inside, Miles saw the scarf on a hook above a tier of shelves and glimpsed a quick movement, too late to withdraw his hand.
"See," Cindy observed when he stopped scratching, "you've only made it worse."
"It feels better, actually," Miles lied, thinking that with a scalpel he could make it feel better still. "If I need a tetanus shot, I'm going to bill your mother." That had been one good thing about his visit to the hacienda. Since Mrs. Whiting was away, in Boston, according to her daughter, David couldn't blame him for not broaching the liquor license issue.
"You'll never guess where I found the little pill last week," Cindy said. "She disappeared the day before, and when I went to the cemetery, there she was, sitting on Daddy's gravestone."
Miles frowned at her. Did she expect him to believe this? Of course, I'd brought her with me before, so she knew which one it was.
"You don't believe me, I can tell."
Actually, Miles wasn't sure which was harder to credit, that the cat of her own volition visited C.B. Whiting's grave, or that Cindy herself did. He knew Mrs. Whiting well enough to doubt she ever paid respects to a man whose memory she'd done everything she could to erase, which meant her daughter would have to make the journey on her own. Miles couldn't help admiring the effort, if not necessarily the motive. He himself had visited his mother's grave only once, and the experience had struck him as little more than an opportunity for melodrama.
What was one supposed to do, standing there at the foot of a grave? Carry on a conversation with its headstone? Plant some flowers? He'd felt more distant from his mother at her graveside than he did standing over the stove at the Empire Grill, or passing by the old shirt factory, or kneeling in her favorite pew at St. Cat's. Even at the Whiting Hacienda, where she'd finally died, his mother came to him unbidden, and for that reason seemed far more real. Visiting her grave amounted to a kind of summons, and it didn't surprise him that his had gone unanswered. He'd vowed at the time that if it turned out there was life after death, he certainly wouldn't linger around his hole in the ground waiting for visitors. "I put flowers on your mother's grave, too," Cindy continued. "I always do. Did you know that, Miles?"
"No, I didn't," Miles said, feigning interest in what was happening on the field below.
"It's a terrible thing to say, but she was more dear to me than my own mother when she was sick and you were away."
Miles rose to his feet. "I better go down and get that cane before somebody makes off with it."
She looked up at him through moist eyes. "Nobody's going to steal a cane, Miles."
Then, noting his distress, "I'm sorry. It's such a beautiful day, and I didn't mean to make you feel bad."
"You didn't," he assured her. "I'll be right back." "I'll wait right here, then," she said, with the same self-deprecating laugh she'd had as a girl.
By the time he got to the foot of the bleachers, a roar went up, and Miles saw that Fairhaven had scored another touchdown. When the noise subsided, he heard his name being called. The caller turned out to be Otto Meyer, Jr., who was leaning up against the chain-link fence. Otto was one of those men who managed to look, as adults, uncannily the same way they had as kids, and Miles never could look at him without seeing a suffering 9-year-old standing all alone on a pitcher's mound. His father was a pushy local life insurance salesman whose self-importance had demanded that his namesake be a pitcher, even though the coach, Mr. LaSalle, had seen in the boy a natural catcher, a natural second-string catcher, which the boy would later become in high school. But Otto Meyer Sr. was adamant, and so his son had been made a pitcher, though Mr. LaSalle refused to put him into games that were not already decided, and sometimes just for the game's final out, with, say, a 7- or 8-run lead. Otto Meyer Jr., however, made the most of that one out, usually facing at least half a dozen batters in order to record it. Worse, he had to sit on the bench each game and listen to his father heckle from the stands until the coach finally relented and sent Otto Jr. to the mound. Though the old man had died of an embolism almost a decade ago, Otto still looked haunted. His own son David was on the football team, and Meyer attended even away games, though he never shouted either encouragement or criticism. In fact, he never even took a seat in the stands, but instead moved from one side of the field to the other, and from end zone to end zone. When Miles asked him why he did this, just to see if he knew the reason, Otto explained that he got too nervous in one place. Miles knew better. His attending every game without being anywhere in evidence was a gift to his son, who could then live the game. "Hello, Meyer," Miles said, the two men shaking hands.
"I just saw Christina over on the other side. She tell you about her painting?"
Miles quickly replayed their most recent conversations.
"I don't think so."
"It was one of two selected from the sophomore class to be in the citywide art show."
"Doris Rodrigue picked something of Tick's?"
Meyer snorted. "Don't be an idiot. I brought in a professor from the college to do the judging."
"Christina didn't say anything to you?"
Miles shook his head, at once embarrassed, hurt, and proud. Their vacation, he'd come to understand, had represented a brief glasnost during which Tick had offered up a few confidences of the sort she'd routinely surrendered as a child. He hoped such openness would continue, but now, a mere month into the new school year, she'd grown remote again. Probably he himself was at fault, at least partly. He'd registered his objection to the Minty boy much too strongly earlier in the week, and as a result, Tick now seemed even more reluctant to share whatever was on her mind. "Lately," he told Otto, "she seems to hide where I can't find her.
The only way I learn anything is through Q&A and then cross-examination. And she tells her mother even less. She's in high school, Miles. They all go to ground. They pause to watch a busted play. Then Miles said, I think she's concluded from the divorce that neither one of us is to be trusted. She could be right. Nope, you're wrong. She's a great kid. She just knew you'd find out eventually. You think? Actually, Meyer confided, I'm afraid I placed an unfair burden on her a couple of weeks ago. I've been regretting it ever since. The Voss boy? He nodded, looking guilty. She say something? Of course not. I heard you gave him a job. That was awfully good of you, Miles. He's a trouble boy. Trouble how? Miles said, recalling Horace's cryptic admonition. The kids all love to pick on him for some reason. I wish I knew more. It seems his parents abandoned him. He lives with his grandmother out on the old Fairhaven Highway. I gave him a lift out there last night, Miles said, recalling how strange it had been. No light left on, not a sign of life. He was the other sophomore whose work was selected for the art show, incidentally. Miles nodded, swallowing something like fear. Last night in the restaurant, he felt the same apprehension and unwillingness to have his daughter linked with this unfortunate creature. Now here he was, grudging the boy's painting being hung next to Tix in a school art show. Insane. And even worse, a fundamental breakdown of the charitable impulse. Miles could feel his mother's sudden presence at his elbow. No need to visit her grave, either. He seems to be a good worker. I can't get him to say two words yet, but Charlene's going to work on him. I always have a hard time talking around Charlene myself, Meyer grinned. She makes me stutter. Miles smiled, remembering when, as a high school senior, he'd finally confessed to Meyer that he was in love with Charlene, only to have Otto sheepishly admit that he was too, which explained why he'd always been so willing to accompany Miles to the Empire Grill, a decidedly uncool place, to have Cokes after school. There was something touching about his old friend's admission now. Meyer had, as far as Miles knew, a fine marriage, but like Miles, he left Empire Falls only briefly for college, then again years later for graduate school, which meant that Meyer also shouldered the weight of his childhood and adolescent identity. Oscar Meyer, the wiener he'd been called. Growing up to become principal of the high school had merely confirmed the worst suspicions of his classmates. Kind of a shame the rivalry game so early in the season, he observed. Miles nodded, noncommittal. I thought a rivalry was when you win some and they win some. Fairhaven had won about the last 10. Both high schools had suffered declining enrollments over the past two decades, but Empire Falls' decline was much steeper, having already dropped from AAA to AA, and it was about to drop again to Class B. Fairhaven, more stable because of the college and a couple of smaller mills that had somehow managed to stay open, had retained Empire Falls on its schedule, but insisted the game be played earlier in the season as a tune-up for more important contests. For Empire Falls, in the tradition of jilted lovers everywhere, it remained the game. Otto Meyer Jr. nodded, watching Empire Falls break their huddle and lumber up to the line of scrimmage. I don't get it, he admitted. Our kids are too big and mean and stupid to get pushed around like this every year. Another roar went up as he said this. Fairhaven had recovered a mishandled snap and was back in business. Damn, Meyer said, shaking his head. Hey, speaking of getting pushed around, will you please stand for school board again? The damn fundamentalists are going to ban every library book worth reading if I don't get some help. You can't leave the good fight to the Jews, you know. This is Maine, and there aren't enough of us to go around. Besides which, some of your people are worse than the snake handlers. Which was true enough. Many Catholics, Miles hated to admit, were trying to out-Jesus their evangelical brethren, though he liked to think Sacré-Cœur Catholics were more prone to this than St. Cat's. I'll think about it, Miles said. I swore I wouldn't after my last stint, but God, Maya blurted out, just listen to us.
Talking about damn school board. Only yesterday we were those kids out there. So long, Meyer, Miles said. I'd like to chat longer, but my date dropped her cane under the bleachers. This provoked a wide grin. I thought that was Cindy Whiting I saw you with. You want to know the truth? I was kind of surprised to see what an attractive woman she's become. Miles couldn't help smiling. Meyer was one of the kindest men he knew, and this was his way of suggesting that if Miles was contemplating marrying all that money, it was okay with him. And as often happened when he ran into Meyer, Miles wondered why they hadn't been better friends over the years. Their mutual fondness hadn't diminished since they were kids, and Miles often got the impression that Meyer could use a friend. One of the odd things about middle age, he concluded, was the strange decisions a man discovers he's made by not really making them, like allowing friends to drift away through simple neglect. It took Miles a few minutes to locate the right section of bleachers, where it smelled as if several decades' worth of elderly high school football fans had been secretly draining their colostomy bags from above. He was sick to his stomach by the time he found the cane leaning improbably against one of the metal supports. Had someone propped it up like that? Could the thing actually have landed that way? By putting one foot into the crotch of one of the supports and pulling himself up, Miles was just able to tap the bottom of the bleacher seat Cindy was perched on. When she bent over to receive the cane, he could see her face, and it was so full of hope and joy that Miles was tempted to remain where he was, or better yet, to bolt. Once the game was over, surely someone would see her sitting there alone at the top of the visitor's section and bring her home. By the time he returned to the bleachers with a couple of sodas, Miles found that his prayer for someone to notice Cindy Whiting had been answered in the way God will sometimes respond to a request that's carelessly phrased. Her companion was Jimmy Minty, and they both waved at Miles as he climbed the bleachers toward them, swallowing hard to keep down the memory of what David had told him last night, that Jimmy Minty had been watching the Empire Grill.
"How come you're sitting over here with the bad guys?" Jimmy wanted to know.
He was in street clothes, and he seemed eager to shake hands, though Miles held a Coke in each.
"You ashamed of your own hometown?"
"We got here late," Miles explained, sliding past both the policeman and Cindy, then staring at the same woman who hadn't wanted to budge earlier until she finally moved down again. Fairhaven, he noticed, had added another field goal, making the score 17-zip. "That forced us to sit over here with the winners," he added, just barely emphasizing the I in sit.
"I wouldn't say this one was over just yet," Minty quickly countered. "My boy Zach's playing a pretty good game. I never seen a kid so fired up as he was this morning."
"He's on the team?" Miles said. This time the policeman flinched. He was almost certain Miles knew that, in which case his chain was being pulled.
"Which one is he?"
Cindy wanted to know, as innocent as a companion was pretending to be and far more interested. Jimmy Minty put a hand on her shoulder and leaned close so they could both sight along his extended arm and out past his index finger, all the way across the field to number 56, now on the bench while the Empire Falls offense tried to figure out what to do with the ball.
"What position does he play?"
"He plays linebacker, Miss Whiting," he explained, his hand still resting between her shoulder blades. "That's on the defense, which is why he's sitting over there on the bench just now. It's his job to patrol the line of scrimmage, make tackles on running plays, rush the quarterback when he throws. You have to be pretty smart to play linebacker, and I expect there'll be some interest in him if he keeps on like he's going. From colleges, I mean. He doesn't have the size to play pro, and I won't have him eating steroids. I told him, I ever catch you swallowing anything you can't buy at the mall, I'll bust your ass as quick as a kid with a kilo of crack cocaine."
"I didn't know they sold crack by the kilo," Miles said.
"However it's sold," Jimmy Minty allowed. "Zero tolerance is what I'm saying."
"How come you're not working the game today?"
"In uniform, you mean?
Well, Miles, I don't work crowd control anymore. Most of the guys you see at the gates and out in the parking lot are rent-a-cops. He took a slender walkie-talkie out of his sport coat pocket and showed it to them. I am on duty, though. Nothing like the Empire Falls Fairhaven game to spark a rumble.
A rumble? Miles smiled, trying to recall the last time he'd heard the term. If you could control the urge to kill Jimmy Minty, he was entertaining enough, unless you liked your humor intentional. This section seems pretty law-abiding, Miles said, but I promise to come find you if a fight breaks out. Jimmy Minty chuckled unpleasantly, confident now that he was being made fun of.
Either that, or you could just quell the disturbance yourself.
He nudged Cindy with his elbow to include her in the joke.
I wouldn't mind seeing that, would you, Miss Whiting? Old Miles here, quelling a disturbance.
Below them, the Empire Falls punter was again trotting onto the field.
Damn, Minty said. Another three and out. Our defense is going to be plumb tuckered out by halftime.
It was indicative of Empire Falls' team that the thing it did best was punt, and the boy who did all the kicking took this moment to launch one that traveled about 60 yards in the air. Unfortunately, it settled securely into the arms of Fairhaven's punt returner before the first Empire Falls player got more than 20 yards downfield, and before they had a chance to make much more progress in the direction of the ball carrier, it became necessary to turn around again, because he'd sprinted past while they were trying to shed their blocks. It was the punter himself who finally pushed the returner out of bounds at the Empire Falls 30. And once again, the tired defense lumbered onto the field, Zach Minty trying to buck up his teammates by cuffing them on the back of their helmets and barking his signals as Fairhaven's offense broke huddle and approached the line of scrimmage. Jimmy Minty again put his hand on Cindy Whiting's back and pointed down at the field.
That's my Zach there, he said. Now we're on defense. They got the ball.
No doubt smelling blood, the Fairhaven quarterback took the snap, drifted back into the pocket, and spotted a receiver streaking down the sideline. The pass he threw was a beautiful, arcing spiral, and virtually everyone, including the officials, turned to follow its flight. Miles, however, saw what Jimmy Minty saw. Number 56 for Empire Falls, a full two beats after the ball left the quarterback's hand, put first his helmet and then his shoulder pad into his kidney. Locking his arms around the quarterback's thighs, he lifted the boy off the ground and drove him into the turf so hard his head bounced twice. The elder Minty leaped to his feet.
Yeah! He cried, shaking his fist in the air. Oh, yeah, did you see that hit?
He was pointing excitedly. Cindy, however, as Miles had good cause to remember, was not the best of students. She'd followed the flight of the ball, and even now, despite Jimmy Minty's insistence, she seemed reluctant to look where he directed. Zach Minty was back on his feet, quickly turning downfield, but the Fairhaven quarterback was still sprawled motionless on the grass, either hurt or aware that his services weren't required just now, the ball having come down in his receiver's arms for a touchdown. The Fairhaven coach, who'd also seen the late hit, now stormed onto the field, pointing alternately at his quarterback and at Zach Minty, who stood with his hands on his hips, staring off at Fairhaven's end zone celebration and shaking his head. One of the officials farthest from the play trotted up the field, nodding his head and pointing at number 56. The officials held a brief caucus, at the end of which the referee took out his yellow flag and tossed it at the Minty boy's feet.
Oh, let 'em play, ref!
Jimmy Minty yelled, an unpopular sentiment here in the visitors' stands.
This ain't badminton.
Is he hurt?
Cindy asked, since the Fairhaven quarterback still hadn't moved.
Nah, he just had his bell rung is all, Minty assured her. He just needs to set there a minute, get his bearings.
The celebration over, the crowd now focused its attention on the quarterback. After a minute, he managed to sit up, then finally stumbled to his feet, his arms draped across the shoulders of his coach and a teammate. When the three of them started for the sidelines, number 56 hurried over and insisted on taking the place of the assisting player. The Fairhaven coach looked like he was going to object, but in the end, he allowed Zach Minty to sling the arm of his still woozy quarterback over his shoulder pad and help bear the rubber-kneed boy off the field. Watching this, Jimmy Minty's eyes filled with tears. "That boy's a class act," he said, nodding at the tableau unfolding below them. "That there's why we have kids, eh, old buddy?" Miles, too, was moved by the scene, though he was unable to share Jimmy's specific emotion. Once the boy was propped safely on the bench, there was a smattering of polite applause, until Zach Minty trotted back onto the field and was greeted with a thunderous ovation.
"That's the kind of lick that turns football games around," Jimmy Minty told Cindy.
His hands cupped at her ear so she could hear what he was anxious that she understand amid the roar. It was the kind of hit that turned more than games around, in Miles' opinion, and suddenly the policeman's continued presence seemed intolerable. "Is there something you wanted to talk to me about, Jimmy? Or did you just come up here because you were plumb tuckered out from quelling disturbances and looking for a place to set?" It was Cindy Whiting who reacted first. She turned to him and blinked, sorely puzzled, it seemed, to hear Jimmy Minty's phrases coming out of Miles Roby's mouth. Minty also heard, Miles was sure of that, but he stared down at the field for several seconds longer before turning toward him. Miles saw that the emotion that had welled up over his son's sportsmanship had drained out of his eyes, which now were hard and empty.
"I apologize for your friend here, Miss Whiting," he said, turning back to Cindy. "Miles and me go way back, but for some reason it embarrasses him that we were friends. He always feels better after making a joke or two at my expense, which I don't mind, not one or two anyway. A man who goes away to college and comes home with a diploma has earned that right, I guess, and I figure I'm a big enough man to take a little lip, as long as it's not too much."
Miles started to say something, then stopped. There was too much phony sentiment being expressed here to respond to any single part of the speech, though of course Miles knew that for a man like Jimmy Minty, trumped-up emotion was indistinguishable from the genuine, heartfelt variety. So he satisfied himself with correcting one fact. "I never got my diploma, Jimmy."
"That's right, you didn't," Jimmy readily conceded, which might have suggested that Miles had fallen into a trap had Jimmy Minty been smart enough to set one.
Too bad Max wasn't with them, Miles thought. The old man was just what the situation called for. He'd be innocently inquiring whether everybody in the police department was issued live ammo, or did the dummies get blanks. Where was Max, anyway? Miles wondered. It was unlike his father to miss a home game. He usually worked them like a pickpocket, which in a sense he was, putting the touch on every other person he ran into.
"Please convey my best wishes to your mother for me, Miss Whiting," Minty said, before turning back to Miles. "You really want to know what I came up here for, Miles? I came up here to tell you I got things all straightened out with your brother, so you don't have to worry. I come up here to say there's no hard feelings. I knew you were mad at me last week, and I didn't want any bad blood between old friends, because that's what we used to be, Miles. Friends. Used to be. Maybe we aren't friends anymore, but that's because of you, not me. You don't want to be friends, that's okay. But I'll tell you one thing. You don't want Jimmy Minty for an enemy."
A roar went up on the field just then, and Miles looked up to see Zach Minty emerge from a pile of bodies and hold the ball up with both hands, first to the stands on the Empire Falls side of the field, then to the Fairhaven fans, an in-your-face gesture that whipped the hometown fans into an even wilder frenzy. The boy seemed to know right where his father was, and when Jimmy saw what had just transpired, he too raised both arms into the air, a mirror image of his son's gesture, lacking only a second football. Even Cindy seemed to understand that something significant had occurred, and she let go of Miles to join in the celebration, madly clapping her hands together. After all, Miles reflected,
There was only her whole life to suggest that this physical abandon might be a mistake. But then again, was it not her whole life that Cindy Whiting was hoping to escape for a few short hours this one particularly lovely Saturday afternoon in early October? Lovelier still for the hint of winter in the air? Then Miles saw her lose her balance and pitch forward, and he caught her arm. But Cindy Whiting wasn't a girl anymore, and Miles's grip wasn't good enough to prevent what would have happened had Jimmy Minty not turned back to give Miles one last look and seen her coming toward him in time to catch her. The look of terror on her face remained there even after she was secure in the policeman's arms, where she continued flailing, as if in her imagination she hadn't been caught at all, but was tumbling head over heels down to the bottom of the bleachers. Only when she was seated and calm again, clutching Miles's sore left arm with both hands, Jimmy Minty having disappeared into the crowd below, did Miles recall the clattering sound he'd heard when Cindy pitched forward and see that her cane had once again fallen to the ground below. Chapter 16. 60 was all Janine Roby, soon to be Como, could think. 60, 60, 60, 60. Down on the field, the game was stalled because one of the Fairhaven players, their quarterback, she heard somebody say, had been injured. She couldn't see much from where she sat, and she wasn't that interested anyway. She'd sat through most of the first half without really watching. Her only interest in the game was that this was the one everybody turned out for. When she was in high school, she'd missed every damn Fairhaven game because she was fat and her mother made her wear stupid clothes and nobody ever asked her out. She'd been savoring the ironic, vengeful sweetness of this particular event for weeks, imagining it in every detail, praying the weather would stay warm enough that she could wear her new white jeans and halter top, which she indeed was wearing, even though it was a little chilly. Walt, who pretended to be a big football fan, mostly just enjoyed strutting around at any social event that didn't require a jacket and tie. He'd even wanted to get there early, but Janine had nixed that goddamn idea right off the bat. What she had in mind was an entrance, which meant that everybody else had to be in their damn seats. The only problem there was that if everybody had already taken their seats, there'd be no seats left open. Like most conundrums, though, this one was hardly insoluble, and eventually Janine thought of her mother. For some time, she'd been trying to think of ways to get the old bat to like the silver fox a little better. She and Walt were getting married, after all, and by the time of the ceremony, she hoped, her mother would at least have stopped referring to him as that little banty rooster. Maybe if Bea had a good time at the football game, it would occur to her that Walt hadn't spoiled it, and that would be a beginning. An afternoon in Bea's company might do Walt some good, too. The Silver Fox didn't have anything against her that Janine knew of, but he did seem to have trouble remembering Bea's existence. Every time Janine mentioned her mother, Walt's eyes narrowed, and he regarded her suspiciously, as if she'd been keeping this person a secret from him. As if he hadn't been keeping the biggest damn secret of all from her. But the real reason for hauling Bea along to the game was so that for once she could be the solution to a problem instead of its source. The plan was she'd call her mother, say they were running late down at the club, and have her go over to Empire Field early and grab three spots, as close as possible to the 50-yard line and all the way up at the top, so they'd have a good view. And also so everybody'd have a good view of Janine in her new white jeans and halter when she and Walt climbed up the bleachers filled with men who never once asked her out when they were boys, and with the women they'd asked instead. Most of these wide loads now took up the better part of two seats, so let them have a good look, too. Janine had learned from all those hours on the Stairmaster that the only time a woman in the right getup is going to look more intoxicating than when she's going upstairs is when she turns around and goes back down them. But, of course, everything had conspired to spoil her entrance, which only went to prove what Janine already knew.
that no matter how well you plan something, God always planned better. If he was feeling stingy that day and didn't want you to have some little thing you had your heart set on, then you weren't going to get it, and that was all there was to it. And today, for some reason, God didn't want Janine Roby, soon to be Como, to have the entrance they both knew she deserved. B had gone early, but she'd put the three cushions down on seats only a third of the way up the bleachers, because any more her feet always hurt from standing all day, and so did her lower back from wrestling kegs, and she didn't see any reason to be all the way up there in the nosebleed section anyway. Had Janine thought about it, she would have foreseen all this, but she'd been concentrating instead on the effect of her outfit. Still, it wasn't really her mother's refusal to follow simple instructions that spoiled the plan. The truth was, Janine was still reeling from this morning's surprise. 60. Down at the county clerk's office, Walt had produced a folded copy of his birth certificate, which he kept trying to smooth out with the palm of his hand. And when the woman at the window asked him to read the date of birth printed on it, he'd silently pushed the document across the counter toward her instead. Janine should have known right then and there that something was up. Actually, she should have been suspicious already. After all those weeks, she'd been trying to get him down there to file for their marriage license so that when her divorce finally came through, they wouldn't have to waste any more time on paperwork. His first excuse was that he couldn't find the damn certificate. And then twice last week, he'd managed to futz around at the club until the clerk's office was closed. Only today did she understand his reluctance. He'd almost gotten away with it, too. The woman had silently typed the date of Walt's birth on the application, then slid his birth certificate back through the slot in the window. Had she folded it before doing so, Janine never would have spotted the faded date printed there. April 10, 1940. 1940? What the hell is that? She said, pinning the document to the counter with the tip of her index finger to prevent the silver fox from folding and returning it to his pocket, a maneuver he seemed anxious to execute. And when their eyes met, his expression was the same one he used when he thought he'd pulled a fast one on Horace at gin. "Is that some kind of misprint?" she demanded. The funny part was, if he'd told her that it was a misprint, she probably would have believed him, because there was no way Walt Como looked any 60. Janine located him now, down on the sideline. It was coming up on halftime, and he was talking to Horace, who was moving a long metal pole with chains up and down the field. Being down there on the field was pure Walt, of course. If there was some place he wasn't supposed to be, that's where you'd find him. He never went into the Empire Grill until it was getting ready to close. For some reason, he liked the sound of the door locking behind him, and the idea that other people would want in too and wouldn't be able to get in. He'd swivel around on his stool